Our reading this morning comes from the 11th chapter of Isaiah, verses 1 through 10. A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. His delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, nor decide by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness the belt around his loins. The wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. On that day, the root of Jesse shall stand as a signal to the peoples. The nations shall inquire of him, and his dwelling shall be glorious. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. In the weeks leading up to Advent, we've been thinking a lot about stories. Embodied stories, generational stories, stories we're aware of, and stories that affect us on an unconscious level. Today, I want to build on that work we've been doing by looking at stories through a different lens, the lens of genre. I think genre is important because depending on the genre we're expecting when we encounter a story, we experience it very differently. I know this well because of an experience I had as a child. Do you all remember the movie Hook, starring Robin Williams as Peter Pan? My dad took my older sister and me to go see that when it came out. I was 4 years old. And at that age, I hadn't quite wrapped my head around the idea of the category of fiction. So when I went into that movie theater, I think I must have experienced it the way you might experience a tragic documentary. Hook, one father's account of the day his children were kidnapped by pirates. The memory is a little fuzzy, but I know that I failed to understand the story as fiction because from that day on, for the next 4 years, before I could get in bed to go to sleep, I had to check every crevice under my bed and in my closet for pirates. So I deeply appreciate the importance of genre in our encounters with stories. What genre do you think today's scripture belongs to? I often feel that the question of genre is particularly difficult when it comes to the Bible, because the language can sound so foreign to us. So to think about this question, let's return to some of the content that we heard. Verse 6, The wolf shall live with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the kid. The calf and the lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them. Verse 8, the nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put its hand on the adder's den. I think it's fair to say we're not hearing Isaiah's guidebook for parenting. Nor is this likely to be a historical record of what was happening in Jerusalem in the 8th century BCE. Verse 9, they will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as water covers the sea. This is a favorite genre of the prophets. This is poetry. Why does Isaiah prophesy in poetry? Poetry is probably not a genre that most of us engage with regularly. And not for no reason. Poetry slows us down. Poetry messes with us. One of my favorite descriptions of poetry comes from a professor at the University of Chicago, Michael Fishbane. Professor Fishbane writes that poetry interrupts the daily flow of language, giving each word an uncommon import. The common world of sight and sound is suspended in poetry. The poet does not so much imitate the world as remake it with words. Remake it with words. How can poetry remake the world? One way to get at this question is to look at the way the root of the word poetry, its etymology, has changed over time. The word poetry comes from the ancient Greek word poein, which means to do or to make. I am not a theorist of poetics, but I have felt the power of poetry on me, and I've seen it at work in this world, in this very congregation. 3 weeks ago, I heard Isaiah practically leap off the page as Pastor Julian read from the 65th chapter. For I am about to create a new heavens and a new earth. Be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating. For I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. And one who dies at 100 shall be considered a youth. Why does Isaiah prophesy in poetry? Poetry invites what our rational minds are so apt to reject. Color, abundance, contradiction, and paradox. So as we move away from looking at the genre of this scripture and zoom into its content, keep this question close. Why does the prophetic imagination so often find expression in poetry? Verse 2, the Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Verse 3, his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes behold, nor decide by what his ears perceive. This is a passage about ways of knowing, church. This is a passage about how we make decisions and judgments. And in this case, Isaiah is writing about the ideal Davidic king. So he's writing not about norms, but about ideals. Ways of knowing. How do we come to the thousands of decisions we make every day? What systems kick in as we render a judgment? How do we know what we know? Scholars think these passages were probably written in the second half of the 8th century BCE. But when I first read these lines, I thought, I know exactly what Isaiah is talking about here. about the folly of making judgments based on what the eyes behold and what the ears perceive. I know what he's talking about because I read a very popular book that came out on the same topic in 2011. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Today, I want to share two of the big ideas from this book, ideas for which Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002. Kahneman describes two ways of knowing that humans use to make decisions. The first is called System One, and it's as simple as this. When you see someone making this face, what's happening? That's right, and you didn't have to take a class to know that. That is System One, that is gut intuition. Kahneman says that when System One is working, we don't feel like we're expending any effort at all to make decisions. System One is effortless. The second system is aptly called System Two, and it's what kicks in when someone asks you to multiply 17 by 24 without a calculator. If you're like me, you need a pencil and paper and a fair amount of time to do this operation. This is essentially a program you learned in school called long multiplication. And it's hard work. It's effortful. Physiology even shows us that it's hard work, because if you do this operation in your head, your pupils will dilate by 50% the entire time that you're working. Humans have a limited capacity for this type of hard work. One of the points of Kahneman's book is that there are situations in which the vast majority of people will try to use System One to solve a problem when System Two is required. He illustrates this with a sort of riddle. Stay with me. I promise I'm going to get all of this back to Isaiah. The riddle goes like this. A bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? I'm going to say it one more time. And if you've already heard it, or you're a smarty pants and know the answer, just keep it to yourself. A bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? The majority of people, including on campuses of Harvard and MIT, will confess that the number that comes to mind is 10 cents. That was true for me, and that's wrong. 10 cents plus $1.10 is $1.20, so that's not the solution. The solution is 5 cents. The ball costs 5 cents, the bat costs $1.05, which makes $1.10. Yeah. It's an excellent example. It's an excellent example of when we as humans tend to be inclined to rely on System One, and that inclination makes us prone to errors. As the book continues, Kahneman describes situation after situation in which most humans will tend to rely on System One to make decisions, resulting in bias and predictable errors. Is Daniel Kahneman a prophet? Has he essentially updated Isaiah's 11th chapter for the 21st century? Verse 2, the Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. Verse 3, his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes behold, nor decide by what his ears perceive. Kahneman's message overlaps with Isaiah's to an extent. He shall not judge by what his eyes behold, nor decide by what his ears perceive. He shall not judge by System One. Yes, it is important to engage our logical minds and double-check our work to prevent the errors that our human biases incline us towards. But there is something missing in thinking fast and slow. And it's something the Nobel Prize in Economics will always be blind to. Isaiah is telling us that ideal knowledge comes neither from the gut intuition of System One, nor from the logical, calculating System Two, but from a different system altogether. In fact, it's not a system at all. It's a relationship. It's in relationship to the I am that I am, in relationship to the ultimate, in relationship to the Lord, that our egos get checked by the terrifying realization of how limited and finite our ability to make good judgments really is. That's when we begin to taste true wisdom. True wisdom is what arises when we check our human arrogance and delight, that is, move towards and get comfortable being uncomfortable in the fear of God. I think fear is a good word for what happens when we viscerally comprehend our finitude, our limitations, our insignificance in the face of all reality. But some translations render it reverence, reverence of the Lord. That fear, that reverence, was missing from ways of thinking 10 centuries ago, and it's still missing today. What are the consequences of naming and prizing only two systems of human decision-making, as Kahneman does? What are we missing out on if we fail to be interrupted and disturbed and slowed down and inspired by Isaiah's poetry, to stop and to ponder the shocking combination of the wolf and the lamb, of fear and delight? When I was a little girl, my mother volunteered in our church as a minister of care. And she would take me along with her when she would bring the Eucharist to homebound members of our church, St. Patrick's. One of our regular visits was to Mrs. Formica, an older woman who had multiple sclerosis. I was probably 3 or 4, so my memories of Mrs. Formica are blurry. But I remember walking into her house for the first time, peering between my mother's legs, and seeing her sitting in her wheelchair, which she was strapped to with belts so that she wouldn't fall out, and having the reaction you might have if you actually saw a leopard lying down with a kid. I felt confused. I felt scared. I wanted to run away. That's system one. That's gut intuition. That's not what we did. My mom walked in with her picks in her hand, and I followed her because I loved her and I knew I would be safe with her. And in that way, over time, I got to know Mrs. Formica, to love and to delight in Mrs. Formica. System two may be less error-prone than system one, but system two has very little to say about that situation. And if it did, it would have told me and my mom not to waste our time, because what Mrs. Formica needed was medicine, and what we had was unleavened bread. System two would say, there's no reason for a little girl to be there. To be there anyway, that is a taste of the world that Isaiah describes. A world born of the prophetic imagination, a world in which delight and fear of the Lord come together. It is poetry, yes, but if we take Isaiah seriously, it is also the potential remaking of our world. Isaiah prophesies in poetry because of the space it affords him for the paradox that so often accompanies revolutionary ideas. For the permission it implicitly grants to put things together that make no sense in systems one or two. The prophetic imagination finds expression so often in poetry because it exists not in the black and white of systems, but in the technicolor landscape of relationship with God. By emphasizing poetry, I do not wish to suggest that paradox and imagination are not possible or not part of other genres and stories. Indeed, the Bible is bursting full of that kind of paradox. We find it in Exodus, when God selects Moses, the guy with a speech impediment, to speak on behalf of his people to Pharaoh. And later, in the book of Samuel, who should defeat the huge warrior Goliath without a helmet or a sword, but using only a smooth rock and a sling? The young shepherd David, of course. And later, in the Gospel of Luke, who is it that cares for the person attacked by thieves and left for dead? It is the so-called enemy, the Samaritan. And as we continue now in this Advent season, we invite to the foreground the two most important paradoxes of our tradition, that of the virgin who gives birth and that of the God who takes human form, the form of a disenfranchised and helpless infant. Last week, Minister Diamond encouraged us to invest in our religious and spiritual life during this Advent season by taking our preparation beyond these church walls so that we may be able to meet God at any moment. God in her fullness, God in his youth, God with a Twinkie on a park bench when we least expect it. This week, I invite us to continue that preparation with a challenge. Instead of relying on the necessary but all too human wisdom of systems 1 and 2, I challenge us to notice what may be keeping us from tapping into our own prophetic imaginations. In my own life, I have noticed that when I have a big decision to make or important planning to be done about the future, I am much more likely to reach for a book like Thinking Fast and Slow than for the book of Isaiah. And although that instinct can serve us well in some ways, protecting us from errors, it ultimately holds us back. I'm going to lay out 2 possible ways of taking up this challenge. The first is a straightforward assignment. Write a poem. That's it. A poem of any length could be as short as a haiku. And as you write, notice. Notice if there is a voice inside of you limiting what you're willing to put on that page. A voice that pipes up and says, "You can't say that," or "That doesn't make sense." The assignment stops there. You're not trying to wrangle that voice or get rid of that voice or censor yourself for having that voice. The work is just to notice. Option 2 is to take that same idea, but instead of writing anything down, the entire assignment is just to notice when you hear that inner critic piping up and telling you that an idea that you have for your future doesn't make sense, can't be done. With this challenge in mind, with this Jesse tree behind me, I want to close with some inspiration. This is a poem I loved as a girl. It's called Where the Sidewalk Ends by Shel Silverstein. There is a place where the sidewalk ends and before the street begins. And there the grass grows soft and white. And there the sun burns crimson bright. And there the moonbird rests from his flight to cool in the peppermint wind. Let us leave this place where the smoke blows black and the dark street winds and bends. Past the pits where the asphalt flowers grow, we shall walk with a walk that is measured and slow. And watch where the chalk white arrows go to the place where the sidewalk ends. Yes, we'll walk with a walk that is measured and slow. And we'll go where the chalk white arrows go. For the children they mark and the children they know. the place where the sidewalk ends.